Each of us has a unique career story to tell. For some, these fly high like rocket launches. For others, they're more like the game of chutes and ladders, with advances and setbacks along the way. Either way, we learn countless lessons from these experiences. And that's what we put into the spotlight here at Career Sessions Career Lessons. Join discussions featuring a variety of guests sharing their stories of ups and downs, as well as the secrets of their success and what drives them to continue moving forward. We break down the tools and resources that will help you establish your dream career and realize your professional goals. Here's your host, J.R. Lowry.
I'm J.R. Lowry, and this is Career Sessions Career Lessons, which is brought to you by Pathwise.io. Pathwise is dedicated to helping you live the career you deserve, providing coaching, content, courses, and community. Basic membership is free, so visit Pathwise and join today. Today, my guest is Dori Clark. Dori is a consultant and keynote speaker and a business school professor teaching executive education at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business and Columbia Business School. She has been named three times as one of the top 50 business thinkers in the world by Thinkers 50, and she was recognized as the number one communication coach in the world by the Marshall Goldsmith Leading Global Coaches Awards. She's recognized as a branding expert by the Associated Press, Fortune, and Inc. magazine, and is the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of The Long Game, Entrepreneurial You, Reinventing You, and Standout, which was named the number one leadership book of the year by Inc. magazine and one of the top 10 business books of the year by Forbes. Dori is also a former presidential campaign spokeswoman, award-winning journalist, and filmmaker, having directed an environmental documentary film, The Work of a Thousand. She was a producer for a multi-Grammy-winning jazz album, is a Broadway investor, and is a member of BMI's Lehman Engel Musical Theater Advanced Workshop. At age 14, Dori entered Mary Baldwin College's program for the exceptionally gifted. At 18, she graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Smith, and 2 years later received a Master in Theological Studies from Harvard Divinity School. Dori, welcome. Thank you so much for doing the show with me today.
JR, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to take one of your questions. We're going to talk about networking, among other topics. I'm going to take one of your ice-breaking networking questions. What's the coolest thing you're working on right now?
Well, right this minute, as we're recording this, one of the things that's most exciting for me is I'm actually flying in a couple of days out to Ohio because one of my side projects, which I actually chronicle in my book, The Long Game, is learning to write musical theater. And right. So the first ever full production of one of my shows is going to be taking place this weekend at Ohio Wesleyan University. So I'm very excited to see it performed. They've got costumes. They've got a three-story set that they've welded. It's going to be off the hook.
That sounds really awesome. That's not far from where I grew up. I grew up in Akron. So there were always a couple of kids every year who went to Wesleyan for my high school.
Amazing. I love it.
Well, beyond that, you have a ton on your plate, which I probably only partially summarized in our introduction. So give the audience kind of a fuller sense of all the things that keep you busy besides the musical theater work that you've been doing.
Certainly. So I do a little bit of teaching. I teach for the executive education program at Columbia Business School. I write books. My most recent one is called The Long Game, How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World. And I also spend a fair amount of my time running masterminds and doing online courses. Some of them I do for places like LinkedIn Learning and Udemy, and some of them I run myself, including my sort of flagship, which is called the Recognized Expert course. And we just had a launch of that, which was really exciting. So I've spent a lot of time immersed in that world as well.
How big are your groups when you do those learning programs that you run yourself?
Typically between 50 and 100 people register for each sort of official cohort. So when people sign up, they actually get lifetime membership in the community. So by now we actually have this, you know, very robust community that's built up over the past 8 years of people who literally stay involved for years and help each other kind of rise together. It's really lovely to watch. We actually had this week our 64th community member get published in the Harvard Business Review, just as one metric of people's success that they've experienced. So that's really fun to watch.
That's a pretty impressive stat because it's not easy to get published in Harvard Business Review.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. There's definitely some strategizing you have to learn about what is of interest and how do you present things in the right format. So like everything else, it's a learnable skill. It's not easy.
Let's go back to the beginning. Tell us the Dory Clark origin story. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in North Carolina and did everything I could to get out very quickly. I was not meant for a little tiny small town life, I think. So when I was 14, there was an early college entrance program at what was then known as Mary Baldwin College, now Mary Baldwin University in Virginia. And so I did my first 2 years of college there, and then I transferred to Smith College in Massachusetts, and I finished up by the time I was 18, which was really exciting because I did want to get a bit of a head start on things. So that was pretty cool. Did you like growing up in Akron? How was that for you, JR?
I liked it, but my family all moved away and I don't really go back very often. I have a high school reunion coming up this summer, so maybe I'll go back for that, but it's probably been close to 20 years since I've been back to where I grew up, so I'm overdue.
So I've been more recently. I guess it's been a little while for me too, but I did a presentation at Goodyear, which was really fun. They're a cool company there.
I mean, you know, when I grew up, it's the big three auto tire companies were all there, Firestone and Goodrich and Goodyear. And a lot of people I knew, their parents, one or both of their parents worked there. And that was back when they actually made tires in that area. And a lot's changed since then. And the city's kind of had to reinvent itself since then, like a lot of cities in the Rust Belt had to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Big changes for sure.
So you were young when you were in college. What did you envision? You were obviously in a rush to get out into the world. What did you envision doing at that point professionally?
It's interesting because one of the things for me that feels very salient about the modern economy is that in some ways I've managed to have like every facet of every career that I wanted to have. And then on the other hand, which is like very ironic, it's like I wanted to do all these like things that felt very cool to me. Yeah. But what has happened is that the economy has changed so much. It's kind of just that the bar was decreased somehow and things were demonetized. And so a problem that I actually tried to solve in my book, Entrepreneurial You, is the fact that it's like you can do anything you want to do. You just can't really make money at it these days. And so you have to figure out your back end if you're going to be successful. So the things I was interested in, I wanted to be a filmmaker. I thought that would be really cool. I wanted to write books. I wanted to teach at the university level, like all these things. And it's like,
check, you've done all those things.
Got to do all these things. And yet what we see, of course, is anybody can be a filmmaker now on their phones. You don't have to have Hollywood backing you, but it's a really different process. And so understanding this like modern conundrum of like, yes, you can do it all. Anything you want to. Yeah. You want to have your own TV show. Great. That's what YouTube's for. You can do it. But you have to figure out how to make it work in the context of an economic system. And so I really wanted to crack the code on that on Entrepreneurial You, because we do all have to be entrepreneurial. It drives me bonkers when people still today will sort of complain that people aren't giving them things or whatever. It's like the modern economy has evolved so that no one's giving you anything. We have to figure out how to make our thing and how to make it work. But if you do, it means the sky's the limit. You can do whatever you want, which is an incredible opportunity.
Yeah, but it is a big mindset shift. I mean, it's akin to like the pension world giving way to the 401k world in the US, right? It's like now you got to plan for your own retirement. It used to be that you went to work for a company, like a Goodyear, and you worked there your whole career. And then you retired at age 55 or 60. You got a nice watch on the way out the door and a pension, which is probably more valuable than the watch. And that's changed. And now people have to think about, am I saving enough for retirement? And I think in the same way, it's like, am I taking care of my career? Because I'm not going to have a company that's going to take care of me for my entire professional life. And it's just, it's a big mindset shift.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's not that one is necessarily better than the other, but the critical thing is that everybody has to be on the same page, because where you really get into trouble is if employers and employees have differing expectations and somebody feels really cheated in that equation. That is not going to work well. But a very formative experience for me was getting laid off a year into my very first job and just realizing like, oh, okay, nothing is really secure here. You can kind of make your own security if you have a strong brand, if you have a good network, you know, you can find a way to land on your feet, but people are not necessarily going to take care of you. And it's on one hand, a little bit alarming. But on the other hand, as long as we recognize what the rules of engagement are, then, you know, it's okay. We can figure it out. We can make it work.
Now, part of that is personal brand. I know you've written a lot about that in your books and otherwise. For you, what is the essence of having a personal brand?
Really, I just think of personal brand as a synonym for your reputation. That's really it. And I think it cuts through a lot of the noise around it because personal brand has become a kind of loaded term. It has become conflated in some people's minds with being an influencer and sort of shallower manifestations of it. But the truth is, I mean, I think for all of us at a really basic level, it is helpful to us. It is a good thing if the way that other people think about us is pretty close to how we would like them to think about us. If we can make those things match, our life and our career is much more likely to be healthy and happy and manifest the way we want it to. And so that's really the question is, how do you close the gap between how you want to be seen and how you are seen in the world?
Whether you realize it or not, we all convey a brand, right? People know us for things. They know us not to be other things. And that ultimately is how they see us. That's our reputation, the perception that we give, all of that. And it isn't just for influencers.
Absolutely. It's the thing that makes somebody say, oh, we have this amazing opportunity. Who would be good for that? And you want it to be you. You want them, if it's something that's genuinely exciting for you, you would like to come up, you know, reasonably quickly as being somebody's first choice for that. And so it's just putting in a little bit of thought upstream to ensure that the message arrives with the right people downstream.
So what are some of your tips for people in terms of how to think about, I guess, articulating what their personal brand is?
This is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about, actually dating from my very first book, which was called Reinventing You. So ultimately, with personal branding, I mean, I think to a certain extent, we sort of fixate on like, what are the adjectives? What should it be? And that is an important starting point because, of course, you know, we want to understand both how we're perceived now and where we want to go. This is what enables us to make a plan to kind of triangulate it. But ultimately, I would say that the first starting point is actually really talking with trusted friends. A quick exercise that I like to do is to have you go to a half dozen people that you trust and just ask them super quick, if you had to describe me in only three words, what would they be? And this is helpful, you know, not because you're going to be receiving information that like you've never heard, like, oh my God, I didn't know people thought that. It's probably not right. You're probably going to hear things and you're going to nod along and say, okay, yes, I get that. But what is helpful is the problem with most of us is that we don't understand what people think of first when they think about us. We know too much about ourselves. And so we have no idea about the weights, the proportions, whatever it is. But if you ask half a dozen people and five out of the six of the people, the first thing that they say is, oh, JR, he's so creative, or oh, he's so strategic, or whatever it is, you begin to understand, oh, this is something that people think is like a big thing for me. This is different than other people. And it gives you something to work with. Now, it turns out that might not be the thing you want. You might actually say, oh God, I didn't know it was that. I'll have to find ways to mitigate against it. But you also might be inspired enough that you take it and run with it. Oh, I didn't realize people thought I was so creative. Oh, how can I leverage that more? Maybe that can be sort of a marquee part of what I bring to the mix. So I think a really useful starting point is do a survey. It can be very informal, but see what comes back and see if you like it or not.
Do you ever ask people to go out and ask people, like, pick three words you would say are definitely not me?
You can certainly do it that way. That's an interesting way to kind of highlight the converse, as it were. It's a little harder for the recipient because they have to strain their brain a little bit more to think of the negative, but that could be an interesting variation for sure.
I think about it only because there's so many times where somebody will say, God, they didn't even think of me for this. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, like, what do they think of me? Right. And where's the disconnect? And, you know, maybe coming at it from both angles, you might get a little bit better sense of why they didn't think of you for something. Right. Because as you said earlier, you want them to think of you when it's something that you really feel like you could do, that you want to do. And yet I certainly hear from a lot of people, you know, going back to our pre-recording conversation about the mid-level people, a lot of times they're frustrated because they feel like their bosses don't get them.
No, it's absolutely true. And a big problem that I see, I mean, one of the chief ones, honestly, is it's not necessarily that people have you wrong in like a complete sense or whatever. And it's certainly not a malicious thing. It's just people are busy, they're distracted, they're not focused on you. And so they're just kind of checked out when it comes to understanding who you are. So it's more a sin of omission than commission, but they're just not thinking about you. And so a big problem is the perception that they have of you is often out of date. Like when we first meet someone, of course, we form a perception of them. Like, who's this guy, JR? I need to understand what he's about. But then they know you for 5 years, for 10 years. Unless something has happened, it never occurs to them like, I need to update my perceptions. Meanwhile, over the course of 5 or 10 years, you could have changed careers. You could have gone back to school. You could have moved continents. You could have done a million different things. But they're still thinking of you as whoever you were in 2013 or something ridiculous. And it's just different because it's out of date. So we have to be a little bit more thoughtful about making sure that we are updating people, that we are, you know, sort of reaching out, that we're keeping in touch with them. And that when we do talk to them, we kind of low key way, but we make sure to say, you know, I'm living in England now or whatever, so that it finally sticks.
Well, so I think about like, I've actually had conversations like this where somebody will say to me, you and I worked together back at such and such. You probably remember me like this. I'm now doing X, Y, and Z that are completely different. And let me tell you a little bit about it. And it's almost like, you know, they're deliberately working at resetting your perception of them. Most people kind of let you figure it out, but some people actually will spoon feed it to you, which is in the scheme of things, if you've made a big shift in what you're doing, can be really helpful.
It absolutely is. I mean, you need to say it more repeatedly than you might imagine. You know, there's this saying in politics, which is sort of carried over into the corporate world as well, but I used to work in politics, would say as kind of this adage that a voter needs to hear your name 7 times before they'll remember it. And it's very true with any form of corporate communication. You know, you've got the bosses who are always like, well, I always tell my people I appreciate them. And, you know, the workers are like, yeah, when was the last time that happened? And you've got the disjunct, but we say it once and we assume, it's taken care of. And we have to like 7X whatever we're doing. So thinking through like, if I need this person to understand that like, yes, I'm in a new industry now, or yes, I have a new career aspiration now. It's not that you say the same thing precisely 7 times so that you sound like a robot, but you've got to find different ways in. You know, maybe it's you have a conversation where you talk about it. Maybe you're connected on social media to the person. So you start posting more regularly about the new thing that you're trying to do. So they see it in this kind of ambient way. Maybe there's some kind of an event that is tied in with your new industry and you invite the person to a reception with you. And you try to hit them in different ways so that it really sticks.
For somebody who's kind of got a good sense of themselves, right? But they're thinking about like, how do I find the most impactful ways of conveying my brand, right? Online, offline, whatever. What's your sense of what are the most impactful ways of getting that message across to people?
There's a variety, honestly. I think ultimately it's about repetition and it's about variation. So it's not necessarily that like, you should always do this thing, but it's about trying to kind of create an echo chamber around the people you're trying to influence so that they begin to see you in this new way. And so just by way of example, one of my favorite pieces of advice that I like to suggest to people is inevitably, you were asking earlier, JR, about networking, which is a topic that I have a whole chapter about in my book, The Long Game. So there is this moment where you have a perfect opportunity. And that is if you see somebody that you already know, but you haven't seen them for a while, they are inevitably, this is literally true, inevitably, they are going to ask you some variation of, so what have you been up to? What's the latest news with you? They're going to want to know something like that. And they will ask you. And most people, even though they understand intellectually that that question is coming, they don't prepare for it.
Yeah.
And so as a result—
Same old, same old.
Yeah, they just blow it. But instead, if you really have a thoughtful answer ready about, I've been doing X, Y, Z, then they're listening because they asked, right? It's not you bragging or whatever. They've asked you a question, you're responding to it. So this is a perfect low-hanging fruit if you just have that answer in your back pocket.
So I want to get to networking in a sec, but I wanted to ask you one more question on branding that I heard you talk briefly about at a conference that we were both at together. And that is the idea that a personal brand is sort of like the ant to the threat of AI.
Yes, yes. So it's interesting. I mean, you know, everybody, of course, is trying to wrap their arms around AI and what it can do, what it can't do, whose jobs it's going to displace. Because, of course, 5 years ago, the thing that everybody was freaking out about is, oh my God, the truck drivers, they're all going to lose their jobs thanks to the AI-enabled self-driving cars. Right. And they might yet lose all their jobs, but it's not going to be tomorrow. It is actually much more likely that a lot of white-collar workers are suddenly going to be losing their jobs thanks to the way that generative AI has evolved so quickly. So we're all trying to figure it out. But the truth is, what AI has shown us is that we know that this is true. If you have, let's say, an outsourced marketing agency and you're paying them $2,000 a month, $5,000 a month, whatever it is, and they're coming up with some social media copy for you and different things, and you're like, whatever. Like, it's annoying to me that I have to pay them this money. They do an okay job. They're not the best, but you know, they get it done. If I have been paying $5,000 a month for this service and suddenly I can get ChatGPT to do it for me for $20 a month, right, I am going to be all over that. I am not going to deal with this kind of quasi-mediocre marketing firm. Why would I? Even if ChatGPT is not quite as good, let's call it 80% as good, which that's debatable. It's probably better than that. But even if it's 80% as good, if I can take the delta between $20 a month and $5,000 a month, I'm going to do that every time. The mediocre, the commoditized is going to go away. What is not going to go away probably is if I were to say to you, oh, but JR, I have literally the best marketing firm in the world. They are incredible. They do such unique work and they capture my voice perfectly. And whenever I post something, I get so much positive feedback because it's just so creative and so innovative. Even if AI can do a pretty good approximation of that, I am not going to give up the best firm in the world that I feel like uniquely speaks to me, gets me, connects with my customers, et cetera, because they have a brand that is a premium brand. I'm willing to pay more for that. Yeah. And it's like that for all of us as employees. It's not saying that you necessarily have to be the best in the world, although, of course, that helps. But if people say, you know what, JR is so good with our customers. Our customers love him. He's the best. They all are just saying wonderful things about him. Am I going to get rid of JR when we're having cuts? No, because it's going to make my customers unhappy. There's a wide variety of things where you can excel, but we need to think about how do you create a brand where you are viewed as truly something different and special in whatever element you're doing. And if we have that, that becomes our career insurance.
Very well. I think it highlights the importance of making sure that what you do is unique and distinctive. Like you say, don't have to necessarily be the best, but I think AI is going to force the white collar workers in many industries to raise their game. Because there's a $20 a month alternative to that $5,000 a month mediocre marketing firm. So
it's really true. I mean, I have long felt that there's a pretty wide swath of middle-class white-collar employees that think they're worth a six-figure salary because they've been getting a six-figure salary. Just because you've been getting a six-figure salary doesn't actually mean you're worth a six-figure salary. It means you've gotten it in the past, but the past does not predict the future. What makes you worth it is if you actually, in an open marketplace where you had to replicate that again and again, could you get a six-figure job again somewhere else? Could you do it repeatedly if we had to run the experiment 100 times? If you do, then all right, absolutely. The market has spoken. You're worth it. But if a thing that you lose and you can't really replicate, that is a little too precarious to me. And that's why I am so big on beating the drum around building your network and building your personal brand, because those are the insurance policies. That is what enables you to replicate the six-figure salary again and again across a world of infinite universes.
Let's talk about networking. You know, you've talked a minute ago about how important it can be to somebody's professional success. A lot of people still find it kind of superficial and phony, but It shouldn't be. It doesn't have to be, right?
Yeah. I actually think that if it feels phony to either the person receiving it or the person doing it, it's not being done right. The way that I think about networking fundamentally, and this might sound naive to some people, but it's really just basically about making friends. It's how adults make friends. What is different is that if you have a long enough horizon, you need nothing from anyone. When I'm networking, the last thing I ever want to do is need something from people. That I want to remove all need from the equation because I just want to get to know people and have fun and make friends. Now, sometimes do I need something from my friends? Yes, I do. But needing something from friends is a very different phenomenon. That is something that everybody understands because friends help each other and they do it without keeping score. And I'm willing to do it for you and you're willing to do it for me. If I need something from a person I'm just meeting, that creates a kind of disgusting dynamic that people can sense and that I want to stay incredibly far away from.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I think having been in sales type roles in the past, I mean, you do go into a meeting with somebody you haven't met before, trying to push something, right, to get a sale. You may be playing a long game, to use your book title. You may need to play a shorter game in terms of getting immediate results. And those are hard situations because, you know, you haven't really built the relationship with the person on the other side. They don't trust you. They don't know you. It makes it a lot harder for them to kind of commit, right? Commit time, commit money to whatever you happen to be in there. And I certainly, from my early days being in more sales focused roles, I did not get that. You know, just the fact that you really had to kind of play the long game, build a relationship, and let good things kind of happen as they may.
It's hard because there's really a kind of inverse relationship. The needier you are coming across, the more you are going to be repelling people with that neediness because they see it and they're like, I can't trust this person to have my best interests at heart because their need is so great. They're going to do whatever it takes. And so it sets off people's alarm bells justifiably. And so always, I mean, sort of the central theme of my book, The Long Game, is about how do you thread the needle between short-term and long-term concerns. But ultimately, the more you can set up a system so that wherever possible, biasing toward the long-term, you're going to be a lot better off because it enables you to have almost unpredictably, unexpectedly good payoffs because most people, they want to eat the marshmallow now and not let it multiply to 2 or 3 or 10 marshmallows. But if you're the person who's willing to wait for the pile of marshmallows at the end of the rainbow, there can be a lot of marshmallows there sometimes.
If you're sort of bringing to mind that child psychology research that was done decades ago, where
Walter Mischel
actually showed that the kids who could wait for the second cookie actually ended up being happier, doing better in life than the ones who wanted the instant gratification. So it's a good metaphor, I guess, for the patience of networking.
Yes, absolutely.
So what are the places, I mean, conferences and industry events and things like that are the obvious places to network? What are some of the sort of less obvious ones that you think are particularly fruitful, more than people think?
So I have two answers. One, of course, is that networking can take place almost anywhere. I have a friend named Terry Rice, sort of got his big break, I'll say in air quotes, because he lives in Brooklyn and he took his daughter to like gymnastics class or something. And while he was waiting to pick her up, he recognized this guy that whose picture he had seen, who was the editor of Entrepreneur Magazine. And he's like, hey, I know you. And it started a connection that ended up with Terry doing a podcast for Entrepreneur and writing a regular column and things like that. So if you keep your eyes open, you can sort of network anywhere. But the part that I'll say specifically that I think is more controllable is people often think about networking as occurring in sort of certain zones, you know, as to your point, like, oh, it's a conference, I can network here. A lot of people, I think, have a failure of imagination when it comes to networking because they do not see themselves as hosts or understand that they can be hosts. They think of themselves as sort of passive recipients of networking, like, oh, I can go to an event or maybe someone will invite me to something, but they don't really recognize that they can create something. And so I would really encourage people, invite somebody out, invite them to coffee, invite them to a Zoom chat, host a dinner. Anyone can do this and can actually get really good at it. And it's one of the best superpowers because it's extremely underutilized.
That's certainly something from your books that I've taken away, and you do a lot of, right? Your masterminds that you host and dinners and other things that you do to kind of bring groups of people together, and you ask them to bring people. So you start bridging into their connections. I mean, there's a little bit of serendipity in those situations, right? I'm sure some of them work better than others, but to some extent, serendipity is responsible for a lot of good things that happen in the world. And you just have to kind of foster it a bit.
Yeah, that's very, very true. How do you handle your personal networking, JR?
I don't go to a ton of conferences just because of the time commitment, but certainly I'd stay pretty active on social media, mainly LinkedIn, not so much the other platforms. And it's just nice to see what people are up to, right? And seeing you spoke at General Mills, you got your Wheaties box that we were talking about earlier that you've got in the background there. And I saw that on LinkedIn, commented on it at the time. And to me, it's just fun to see those kind of updates for people. That's a way of kind of building a little bit of relationship with somebody, even if it doesn't turn into anything material one way or the other at any point in the near term. Other than that, I mean, this podcast is a way for me to network, right? I mean, I've started with people that I knew. Over time, I've got more publicists reaching out to me now and asking me if I'll meet with somebody that they happen to represent. And if I feel like they're a good fit or they're doing something interesting, I'm happy to throw them into the mix, because part of my approach with this is to have a bit of variability in the guest types. So obviously, I'm thrilled when I can get somebody who people are really going to know, like you. And those are super popular with people. And what's interesting is through these discussions, I've done 100 and change of them at this point, like I get connected to other people that I probably wouldn't have otherwise been able to get connected to. And that's great. Wendy Smith is somebody from the University of Delaware who I got connected to through a classmate, Dolly Chu. Wendy Smith connected me to Amy Gallo. She's connected me to other people as well. And so I'm kind of interviewing people that I didn't really know that have come through some of those secondary contacts. Those are some of the ways, I guess, that I've kind of built my network, particularly over the last couple of years as I've done this passion project focusing on career development.
Yeah, that's awesome.
A lot of people find this uncomfortable, you know, the sort of the small talk and the things like that. You have a ton of suggestions for people when you're kind of in the moment at a conference, at a cocktail party. We won't go through the whole list, but maybe just pick a few of your favorites.
It's understandable that people are uncomfortable with small talk, because you might start out with a small talky question just to break the ice, but you want to move away from there pretty rapidly. If someone was forced to have an entire conversation of, oh, wow, it's been very sunny, hasn't it, JR? Like, it's just going to be horrible. It's going to be so boring. Nobody wants that. The goal is to try to use small talk as kind of the tip of the spear to break in and to open something up, to actually learn about the person. And it may turn out that you have something in common with them, which is cool. You can bond over that. Or maybe you just find out something interesting and you are present enough in the moment to say, oh, that's so cool. So let's say we're at a conference and I come up and say, oh gosh, weather's really nice, isn't it? And okay, a sort of lame opening, but you know, it's something. And so you say, yeah, it's really great. I've been loving it. It lets me be out on the water more. And so then I can say, oh, are you a boater or like a water skier? What do you do? And you can say, oh, I do hydrofoil. Oh, I'll be like, oh, I don't even think I know what hydrofoil is. Like, what is it? How did you start doing it? What makes you a good hydrofoiler? And where are the best places to hydrofoil? Like, all of a sudden, I don't even know anything about this thing. And you can kind of educate me. And you're excited because you're talking about this thing you can geek out on. And it's great for me because I'm learning about a cool thing I didn't know about. So you've got to just take it in the moment and like roll with it. If you go in and the goal is like, I have to sell something to him, the whole time you're telling me about hydrofoil, I'm not going to pay attention, because I'll be like, how can I pivot it to insurance policies? Yeah. And it's not going to be good for anybody. If you're just present, you can actually learn a cool thing or make a cool friend.
Very true. All right. Mindful of time, I want to spend a few minutes on sort of this idea of an entrepreneurial mindset. You hit on this earlier in our discussion, but for somebody who's in a corporate job, why is the idea of thinking entrepreneurially about themselves still important and relevant?
I think it's still important for a couple of reasons. One is that if you have an entrepreneurial mindset, it's essentially forcing you to look for creative ideas, creative connections, possibilities. And those are things that, if funneled correctly, can really add value to your company. If you're thinking to yourself, if we have a sort of archetypal, you know, passive attitude, it's like, okay, I'm doing my job. I'm doing what they're telling me. I think we all understand that that's not cool. That's not how anybody really wants us to be now. We have to be entrepreneurial enough in the sense that with this owner mentality, it's like, okay, I am taking ownership over my career, over what I'm bringing. And if I see a process that isn't working, it's good if I come up with a suggestion about how it can work better. And all but the least enlightened bosses will be pleased if you say, you know what, there's a process that actually is really inefficient. I think if we changed this and this, we could do it 20% faster. Most bosses would say, oh, that's really cool, actually. Why don't you implement that, JR? And it's a way to demonstrate your interest, your connection, your potential, and show people like, yes, I have ideas, you know, and let me run with them. So that's really good. The other reason that it's so critical, honestly, is that you can't take it for granted that you will always be at your company. No matter how much your company really likes you, no matter how much your boss really likes you, that umbrella of protection may not last forever. A PE firm swallows you, your boss leaves or gets fired, and you no longer have your protector. A lot of things can happen, and I hope they don't, but it is really good to just have something in your back pocket to recognize, okay, even if I want to be here forever, I might not have the opportunity to be here forever. So how can I be thoughtful at all times to just make sure I have a fallback? I think it's important for people to ask themselves that just so we can be as protected as possible in a very uncertain economy.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of leads into gig economy, portfolio careers, and that's becoming more and more common that people have a side gig. They're doing multiple things at one time to sort of de-risk any one revenue stream evaporating and that being their only source of income.
I think society fundamentally underestimates the risks of certain things. It's always like, you know, you talk about, and people sort of know this intellectually, it's like you hear about the shark attack and everybody's like so freaked out about sharks. And, you know, meanwhile, you have like, whatever, I'm making these numbers up, but it's like 10 people die from a shark attack and you have 100,000 that die in traffic accidents, right? But the right. Shark attack is the vivid thing. So that's the thing we're freaked out about. And similarly, we fail systematically to understand the risk that nowadays it has been proven to us that even the hottest companies, even the hottest industries, you know, the Googles and the engineering jobs at Silicon Valley companies, Right. Those can be cut too. Everybody thought that was totally untouchable. If you're an engineer in Silicon Valley, you can write your own ticket. You're just hopscotching from one victory to another. And then all of a sudden last year, people start getting axed and it's like their worldview was shattered. We all have to recognize that it's just being very Buddhist. We can enjoy the present. We can appreciate the present, but it is not going to last forever.
When you're out part of that hustle culture, you're working multiple things, you can easily burn yourself out too.
It's true. I mean, certainly what I hear from a lot of people is I'm already stressed. I'm overstretched. And in fact, in the long game, one of the things that I talk about is, you know, very famously, Google, they popularized this concept of 20% time. You are able to allocate up to 20% of your time to these non-core projects, these kind of experimental projects, which in the past have yielded great results for Google. Google Gmail, Google News came out of these 20% time experiments that their employees did. So it's obviously kind of cool, valuable thing that can pay off. But estimates today are that fewer than 10% of Google employees actually take advantage of 20% time.
Yeah.
And it's obviously not that they're not creative people or whatever. It's that they are so busy, they just don't have time for it. Because the reality is it's less like 20% time and it's more like 120% time. It's more like do your job and then do this extra thing. And people are already like, dude, I can't. That being said, it's also true that if you do make that little bit of effort, maybe it's not 20% time, maybe it's 3%, maybe it's 5%.
Yeah.
You actually really can get a jump on things in terms of building your skills, building your net, expanding things out, and putting yourself kind of prime opportunity. So we just have to be both realistic, because there's certain times in our lives where we just can't, we're tapped out, but where we do have the bandwidth to try to apply it where we can.
So how do you stay on top of it all?
Over time, what I've tried to do. I mean, it's true, you know, now I'm working less hard than I have in the past. But I've tried to be very strategic in terms of concept I talk about in my books is thinking in waves, just really understanding where you are. I think a mistake that some people make, of course, is they don't want to work as hard. And so they just don't work as hard. I worked like a freaking maniac in my 20s and 30s. I mean, like 7 days a week, you know, which is not great and not really sustainable over time. But I was single and I could, and it helped me build a big enough snowball that it had the momentum that I now am able to cut back a little bit more and have a really quite manageable schedule. But it is largely a product of work that I put in on the front end. Also, as I reach new milestones in my business, I've been working for, gosh, probably 8 or 9 years now. I've had a focus on trying to be thoughtful and strategic about how to build up my passive revenue in my business, sort of the non-time for dollars revenue. Right. And the more that I do that, the more successful I am at that, the more I sort of allow myself to cut back on time for dollars things. So I stopped doing one-on-one coaching probably about a year and a half ago now. So that's saved me a lot of time that I'm not doing. And I continue to reallocate that time toward additional passive income opportunities.
And certainly, you know, those passive income opportunities, if you are participating as a solopreneur, whatever words you want to use to describe it, it breaks that cycle because your time is limited, which means you can only make so much, you know, hourly rate times hours you're willing to work, maximum of 168 a week if you don't want to sleep. And, you know, I think getting into those things that aren't tied to your own time is a really important concept that I think a lot of solopreneurs struggle to get past.
That's exactly right. It becomes really hard because you're just capped literally by the hours of the week. You're capped by the constraints of your own labor. And it's no wonder that people's income plateaus because they just can't do anymore. So you have to change it up and find a way to do something different.
Let's think about how to scale yourself ultimately.
Yes.
Turn yourself into, it's like, you know, this whole adage of platform businesses. It's like making yourself into a platform business.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
Mindful of time, let me ask you maybe one last question, which I ask most of the guests is my last question, which is, if you could go back and tell your 18-year-old, just graduated from Smith self, something about the work world, something about careers that you know now, what would you go back and tell your younger self?
We were talking about this a little bit earlier in the context of my book, Entrepreneurial You, but there's a guy who was a sort of big early internet theorist named Doc Searls. And he had a concept that I thought was really interesting to sort of think about and probe that we were alluding to earlier, which is that thanks to the internet, there's been a shift because you don't make money from something, you make money because of something. And you have to like really probe that. It's like a Zen koan, but I think it's quite profound. In the past, we used to make money from something. You know, okay, I'm a filmmaker, so I'm going to make money from my films because people are buying tickets to my films, right? Yeah. It's a very straightforward transaction.
Yeah.
Whereas now you have a situation where because so much has become free and scaled and demonetized on the internet, you might have a blog or a podcast, let's say. There are some exceptions. Certainly some people make money from their blog or from their podcast because they have millions and millions of viewers and they get advertising revenue. Right. That is less than 1%. Absolutely. The vast majority of people, it's not that it's not worth it for them to have a blog or a podcast. It could be an incredible marketing tool. It could be the best decision they ever made. And yet they might not make a cent from it. It might cost them money because, I have to have a producer. I have to have show notes, you know, blah, blah, blah. They make money because of it, because the right person hears the podcast, hires them for a $200,000 contract. And all of a sudden, years worth of hosting a podcast is paid for because you have landed the exact right person at the exact right time. And so understanding that and mastering that equation in the internet era, I think is quite interesting and powerful.
It's an interesting idea. I'd actually never heard that before, but it is more and more true that people, they build a base and then they monetize what they've built, but in another way. And I guess it's the natural evolution. You go back to, you used to be able to make money writing, producing films, whatever the case may be. And then we democratized all of that. The problem with democratizing is then the money all evaporates and you've got to find some other way to make money. And it's just, we've been in this sort of cycle of constant change, which obviously makes it difficult for people to keep up with. So it's an interesting time that we're in, and that's even before you get to the whole AI thing. So
it's wild. It's wild. Yeah. But thanks for helping everyone navigate it, JR. These are great conversations.
I'm trying in my own small way, Dory. So I appreciate you doing this. I violated one of your rules. It's just wait a year before you ask for something. So I only met you in November and it's April. So 5 months, I'll give myself a 45%. So failing grade, but thank you anyway.
It's a pleasure to violate my rules for you.
I take that as a badge of honor. So you have a good rest of your day and we'll look forward to hearing about how your show at Ohio Wesleyan goes.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I'll just mention for anyone who wants to geek out on any of these topics, I have a free long game strategic thinking self-assessment at doryclark.com/thelonggame. So thanks so much, JR.
Thanks, Dory. I want to thank Dory for joining me today. It was really fun to catch up and talk a bit about personal branding and networking and adopting an entrepreneurial mindset and a little bit about her own journey. Dory is certainly a proponent of taking control of your career. So if you're ready to do just that, you can visit pathwise.io. And if you'd like more regular career insights, you can become a member. It's free. You can also sign up on the website for the Pathwise newsletter. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Career Sessions, Career Lessons. We hope the nuggets of wisdom shared today help guide your path to the successful career of your dreams. This podcast series is part of Pathwise.io, which is here to help you live the career you want. We provide a comprehensive mix of career and professional development events, insights, tools, and exercises backed by a group of leading coaches and other career management experts. If you aspire to something more or just something different in your career, join us at Pathwise.io. You can find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. See you again on the next episode.